Richard Rohr gave this talk, "Today is a Time for Mercy," at St. Paul Church in Princeton, New Jersey, on December 10, 2015.
Very kind. Thank you. It's indeed a privilege to speak in this very special city of Princeton, New Jersey. I remember when I first met Jim, maybe 10 years ago, he told me he was from Princeton. Now, mind you, I've lived most of my life in the West. So I said, "Where's that?" "New Jersey," he said. Well, I found out subsequently you live in a quite beautiful state. So I hope whatever I try to say tonight will somehow complement or add to that beauty. We're speaking in a most auspicious week, where, as you know, Pope Francis threw open the doors of mercy in Rome. He had done it a few weeks previously in Africa, and he asked, actually, that every continent and country would create their own symbolic door of mercy and throw it open. He's a master of symbols, isn't he? He understands that it's never just a symbol, but it's somehow a message. And in fact, let me quote a couple lines that he spoke there, if I can find them quickly. They were really good. Of course. "How much wrong we do to God and His grace when we speak of sins being punished by His judgment instead of speaking of being forgiven by His mercy. We have to put mercy before judgment. And in any event, God's judgment will always be in the light of His mercy, which is infinite." Infinite. Of course, we can't even conceptualize anything infinite. So maybe that's why we fall back on judgment. Judgment is something that appeals to the ego. It gives you a false sense of control, superiority, separateness. Doesn't do the soul much good, but the ego likes to make judgments. It positions me higher than someone else. The ego likes to count and measure. And one theologian who was writing an autobiography of St. Therese, the little flower, as we Catholics call her, and he said, "After Therese, all mathematics was thrown out of the gospel." Now, it should have never been in the gospel. But in fact, it really is, and we hate to admit this, but it is the culture that forms us more than the gospel. I'm sorry, I have to say that. The gospel has a hard time breaking through. And if most of us were honest, we're Americans first, and maybe people of Jesus. But the message of Jesus, as David just beautifully sung for us in his eight Beatitudes, is so utterly counterintuitive, so utterly contrary to common sense. "Blessed are the poor in spirit." Come on. Do you think any of our politicians will quote that? I think so. That they would be certain of not being elected, right? Because we have a contrary worldview that's all about power. And it's in its own way about the law. The law is not enough, we don't need law. But it's all about counting and giving appropriate punishments for those who don't abide by the law. And in many ways, we just transferred that all to the gospel. And the great gospel of God's infinite mercy became for many people a cheap reward punishment system. And I mean cheap, because by its own rules, we would have to judge that probably 99% of the people God has ever created since the beginning of time are burning in hell. Yeah, you know that's true if you're logical. If we're going to follow the rules. Now, what mercy does is always open up space. Space for forgiveness. You know, every time God forgives, God is saying, I know my commandments, but in your case, I'm going to break the rules. That's what forgiveness means. I love relationship more than being right. Every time you forgive someone, you're saying, I prefer our relationship to being right. And that's why some people can never forgive. Because they've been told, sadly, I must say, that the gospel is about being right. And it's pretty much reached its nadir or low point in much of American Christianity, which seems to demand this right. I will be right. I will be certain I'm right. And I will prove everybody else to be wrong. Now, when the church itself does not believe its own gospel, or does not live or model its own gospel, how can we expect the lawyers and the politicians to be any different? We haven't been doing our job. In so many ways, we, as I said, simply took on the ways of the world with a little veneer of Jesus' language. When I was in my younger years, I remember more than one sermon where the priest would dare to throw out the word mercy, but would quickly follow it up. Of course, God's mercy must always be tempered by God's judgment. And that was the remaining message. Judgment always won. So when we have a pope like Pope Francis, who says, who am I to judge? It blows the box wide open. As some even said in editorials the subsequent days, that's your job. That's why we elected you pope. Well, we didn't elect him. To make judgments and to teach us how to make judgments. I think many of us trained in many seminaries got a PhD in judgmentalism. And if you doubt that, I guess you've been told, maybe Jim's told you this in Sunday sermons, the biggest denomination in America is still Roman Catholics, but you know what the second biggest is? Former Roman Catholics. If you put them all together, they're the second biggest grouping of religious people, or irreligious people, however you want to think of it. We weren't really trained theologically or psychologically in the ways of mercy. You have to be taught. You have to have it modeled for you. You have to see people who are at higher levels of consciousness and greater levels of soul and deeper levels of heart. And they have to rub off on you. You can't pick it up from a sermon. And certainly my sermon tonight won't do it either. Just telling people you should be merciful. We often don't have the hard wiring to do it. And I'm going to try to present what I think are the two major theological obstacles to that. And to give you one psychological, if I can call it that, possibility. First, theological problem. When we use the word justice, still when most people do, if you hear it on the evening news, I want justice. What almost everybody means is our Western notion of retributive justice. Quid pro quo, tit for tat. Well, they did learn some of that from the church. That much sin, that many years of purgatory, right? It was all counting. It was all about measuring, judging, and counting degrees of worthiness. But in fact, if we had read the Jewish prophets, and let's be honest, for those of you who are Catholic in this room, most Catholics didn't read the Bible, much less the prophets, because the prophet's sole concern, it seemed, we thought, was to foretell the coming of Christ. That's probably 2% of their message. So it means we missed the other 98%. And if you go to prophets like Hosea, Isaiah, Ezekiel, Jeremiah, you'll see that they teach rather directly a very different notion of justice. And the very word to describe this different notion of justice has not emerged in our vocabulary till the last 25 years. Some of you know it. It's called restorative justice. You don't have a word for something that you don't understand. You don't need a word. Do you know the word nonviolence did not exist in the English and German dictionaries till the early part of the last century? We didn't have a word for nonviolence because we didn't understand it. It wasn't a part of our normal vocabulary, our way of thinking. But here's what Jeremiah, Ezekiel, especially Hosea 2, meant by restorative justice. And it's rather clear in the text. First of all, we need it to be pointed out to us that the Jewish prophets, it's amazing they included their writings in the Jewish Bible. It really is to their credit. Because the Jewish prophets don't have much good to say about the Jews. Do you know that? I wonder if Catholics would incorporate that many self-critical texts. Because it's one reaming out after the other. Telling the Jews they're phonies, they're hypocrites, they don't obey the law, they don't love their neighbor, they don't love God, they're always worshiping false gods. Just paragraph after paragraph are telling the Jews how terrible they are. I'm amazed they incorporated it into the Hebrew Bible. But here's why they did it. Because if you stay with it, you're not too put off by what seems like a pretty negative message. You'll notice that they say, and here is what Yahweh will do to you. He will love you more than ever. He will love you into wholeness. He will pour upon you a gratuitous, unbelievable, unaccountable, irrefutable love that will finally soften your heart. They used a less kind metaphor, a little embarrassing to us, that will circumcise your heart because you're hard-hearted Jews. We wouldn't have the courage to talk to Catholics that way, you know? Because we don't critique the system very much the way they do. Restorative justice is precisely God legitimating, validating a human being in the fullness of his identity. In the fullness of herself. It's like a good parent, frankly. But, you know, you parents know this better than I. What works much better than niceness in the moment of panic or need is threat. The threat goes a long way. As long as all the church's children, that's the way to form them. Threaten them, and now I will lead with that into my second theological problem. Threaten them with eternal hellfire. Now, I hope, maybe just the way I said that, you might begin to know where I'm going to go. You see, how can you teach mercy, as Jesus consistently did, when God isn't merciful? We've got a theological problem at the heart of much Christian theology. Jesus tells us to forgive 70 times 7, but God doesn't. In fact, he burns your behind for all eternity. For all eternity. Hold on to that. Now you know, many of you in this room were raised that way. And most of us repressed it in the unconscious because it's literally unthinkable. And you've never met anybody that hateful on all this earth. Maybe someone who'd burn you for a day. But for all eternity? We've suddenly got a toxic image of God. An unworkable image of God. Unworkable. The whole mystical journey is not going to happen until that image is undone. I was able to spend some time with some spiritual directors and contemplative teachers here at the theology school this afternoon. And they seem to recognize, as I have done over years of spiritual direction, both giving it and receiving it, that much of your work, the first 2 years, is undoing people's dysfunctional, sick, tyrannical image of God. Why would you want to spend an hour of silence or aloneness or intimacy I've been lucky as a Franciscan to spend many of my Lents alone in a hermitage. You're not going to do that if this God is out after you. If you don't really feel safe with this God. And a lot of people do not feel safe with this God. John Sweeney wrote a book recently in which he said, you do know that our Christian notion of hell largely comes from several unfortunate metaphors in Matthew's gospel. It's not found in the first five books of the Bible. It's not found in John. It's not found in Paul. But you know where it really is found is in Dante's Divine Comedy. Did you have to read the Purgatorio and the Inferno in college? I did. It's brilliant Italian poetry. It's horrible Christian theology. Horrible. And that has become our living image, pictured in many of our European churches. In fact, it's in the Sistine Chapel. We don't have Jesus meek and humble of heart, with his arms open, welcoming us by mercy, but threatening us with damnation. Brothers and sisters, this won't work. Now, if you think I'm some liberal from New Mexico, I want to quote Pope Benedict XVI. And if you doubt me, you go order on Amazon tonight his book on the Apostles' Creed. If you've ever read, you've pronounced the Apostles' Creed, and right in the middle of it is this most confusing line that little children often ask about. What does it mean that Jesus descended into hell? I remember asking that. I was third grader, so sister, why did Jesus go down to hell? And she said, to get Abraham and Noah. Of course, you don't disagree with your third grade sister, but you want to say, what are Abraham and Noah doing there? Of course, what no one pointed out is the very words used are Hades or Gehenna, having nothing to do with our later medieval notion of eternal punishment, but simply Sheol, the place of the dead, the sort of limbo place awaiting the final judgment when God will finally win. And as Paul says in Corinthians, be all in all. But Pope Benedict says, well, here's what it means. So don't call me a heretic, right? Unless you're going to call Benedict a heretic too. He says, if Jesus went to hell, that means there is no hell. He says, because Jesus and hell cannot coincide. Once he got there, he undid it. If any of you are from the Eastern Orthodox churches, you'll find this is one of their most popular icons, where you have this pit. Perhaps you've seen it. Go to a good bookstore tomorrow and buy it. There's chains flying in all directions. And Jesus has his legs spread, bridging the gap and pulling people out. It's called in the Orthodox Church the icon of icons. Showing the highest level of contemplative perspective, contemplative meditation. So, brothers and sisters, we got our work to do. Because this is where a lot of our people are trapped. It's why even on, I guess, a somewhat free Thursday night, we're only a half-full church. Because we don't expect anything exciting, liberating, merciful, freeing, inviting, alluring. We've worked for years, and for the Protestant brothers and sisters, I must say, for the most part, you didn't reform us Catholics on this. You did the same thing all over again, huh? Because it works. It works at the lowest level of consciousness. Fear and threat work. I won't name some of the politicians who are on the scene, but they've got the entire country in the grip of fear. And it works. So there's no reason to change it. It works. It's only people at the higher levels of consciousness who don't think that way. You know, two of my favorite scripture scholars, Walter Brueggemann, the Old Testament scholar, and Cardinal Walter Casper, two Walters. Haven't we got Father Walter here or something? I think so. And they both point out that the creed of the Jewish people, which is found actually in a number of formulations, but perhaps most clearly in Exodus 34, was this. Well, before I get to Exodus 34, let me build up to that. Moses has broken the tablets the first time. He's so angry at himself and afraid God is angry at him. And he says, Yahweh, show me your glory. And he said, Yahweh said to Moses, I will make all my goodness pass before you. And I will proclaim before you the name. The name is I am who I am who I am. I am existence itself. I am being itself. I am consciousness itself. Choose your word, they're all true. And I will proclaim before you the name Yahweh. And I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious. And I will show mercy on whom I will show mercy. What we have here already in the wonderful Jewish scriptures is proclaiming the absolute freedom of God. Now, what we've come from are centuries of making God abide by our laws and our theology. Because we declare someone to be unworthy or unacceptable, and we can only operate in finite terms, we pull God down to the center. And we have a pretty finite God, as many have said before me. God created us in God's image, and we returned the compliment and created God in our image. You know? And after a while, we didn't have any infinite God, infinite mercy. It seemed like it was only infinite hatred, which you know already. It's saying much more about us than God. You see, if you want to be violent, if you want to kill all the Canaanites, the women and children included, which is spoken rather clearly in Joshua and Judges, then you want a violent God to justify your violence. You become the God you worship, brothers and sisters. You're just like the God you worship. If you're stingy and small and petty, I would be willing to bet if I could be your spiritual director and we could have some good hours together processing your prayer life, I would be willing to bet that your God is stingy and small, counting, you know, sort of much more like Santa Claus. Making a list, checking it twice. You want to find out who's naughty or nice. Jim and I were in Manhattan. I spoke at Trinity and Wall Street and St. Francis on 31st Street. And I said, oh, let's go see Santa Claus. Amazing. You know, I'm a Midwesterner. I've got to see these places when I come here. Well, you had to go up to the 8th floor. And they wanted you to go all the way through Macy's. And then there's a big wall, and apparently we didn't have the humility or the patience to wait in the line, but he's on a great big throne. You've got to climb up to Santa Claus. Brothers and sisters, I'm not exaggerating. People's operative image of God in at least 5 out of 10 cases is Santa Claus, who rewards the good kids with toys and punishes the bad kids with lumps of coal. That's no better than a cheap novel. That's not the great good news. That's not what God came to earth for. John Duns Scotus, our great Franciscan philosopher and theologian, he said, theology, good theology, has two major tasks. It has to keep people free for God. That's basically good psychology and good knowledge of human nature. But to keep the full highway to God open that we read about last Sunday, you have to keep God free for people. It's got to be a two-way road. And if you don't have good spirituality or an honest inner prayer life, invariably you'll end up with Santa Claus. And the great gospel becomes a cheap novel of reward and punishment. Because you see, the quid pro quo world of tit for tat makes sense to the ego. It's all about measuring and counting. When you fall into the ocean of mercy, you stop counting. Counting doesn't make any sense anymore. You know, it's all unearned. That everybody is saved by grace. That everybody is saved by mercy. We went, of course, to the site of the Twin Towers, which I haven't seen. I suppose most of you have. And I couldn't help but be in awe of the design, the architecture. But perhaps you look closely that when the water falls into the second lower pool and pours constantly, it pours into what looks like infinite darkness. No one can see the bottom. I said, my God, that's a metaphor for God. Mercy eternally pouring into infinite darkness, never giving up on filling up the space. Mercy fills the gaps of the universe. Counting never will. Counting and measuring never will. And on the days when you're counting, mercy will not come easily to you. Back to Exodus 34. Then the Lord passed before Moses, and he said, the Lord, speaking of himself, Yahweh, Yahweh, I am a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. Because see, Moses thinks he's going to get it for breaking the tablets the first time, and God's going to give them to him all over again. But he's preparing him, don't understand the law apart from these words. So Walter Brueggemann and Cardinal Walter Kasper both say, this in effect is the creed of the Jewish people. You'll find it in five formulations in different Old Testament books. The Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping that steadfast love, the Hebrew word was hesed, for the thousandth generation, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin. Now, you say, but Richard, there's a lot of other passages that don't talk that way. That sure sound like God is primarily punishing. So before I go ahead, because I know you'll use this to fight me, I want to give you a little what we call hermeneutic, which is your science of interpretation of the Bible. If you don't declare your hermeneutic, you can make the Bible say whatever you want. And we've seen fundamentalism do this with slavery, with apartheid, with almost every form of bigotry possible. If you want a passage to justify your small-mindedness, it's in there. You say, well, why did God allow those terrible passages to be put in the Bible? I learned this from a scientist. Some of you are probably much more educated in that than I am. But they have a concept called negative capability. Maybe it's a new word to you. It's a new word to me. That in fact, the pullback, the resistance to a force, in fact motivates doing it right and thrusting you forward toward the positive. So, what motivates you to love is basically those days where you wake up and say, I haven't loved at all. I don't know how to love anybody. I was really an idiot yesterday. That's negative capability. It creates a vacuum inside of you which makes you desire both love and mercy. The spiritual journey is not a straight line. You don't go forward just marching into heaven, doing it right, as the Bible itself mirrors, and it's in the Bible. The text itself is three steps forward, two steps back. Three steps forward, two steps back. Three steps forward, two steps back. Now, for some dang reason, negative people, I have to call them that, they just love the two steps backward quotes. They do. They just glom onto them, you know? If it's punitive, if it's exclusionary, if it's against gays or somebody that we've decided not to like, they'll just choose it. Ignoring, you know, the whole previous chapter. You can find whatever you want. But you've got to know, I talk about this in my book, Things Hidden, that the Bible itself gets it and doesn't get it. And we did history a great disservice when we said every line is equally inspired. I don't think so. Some of the most horrible literature I've ever read is in the Bible. That's probably why we Catholics didn't read it, you know. We weren't taught about negative capabilities, you know. And so when they're raping women and storming the Canaanites' villages, we don't like that. And it was probably good Christian common sense that we didn't like that. So we just slammed the book shut, you know. It took Luther and the good Protestants to come along and teach us that maybe we could or should or ought to read the Bible. Because without it, we can go to more, even more preposterous dimensions. So basically, with this belief in a tyrannical, toxic God who tells you to love your enemies, but he doesn't, you've got to know we've created what psychologists would call a schizophrenic kind of Christian. You're split. I had to split for years before the Franciscans gave me wonderful spirituality and wonderful theology to show me how to put it all together, how to integrate the negative instead of thinking you could ever exclude it or eliminate it. That doesn't work. Because when you try, you become a mirror image of the very thing you hate. You do the same thing in kind, and we see, you know, much of our politics now wanting to do exactly that. We say the rest of the world is dangerous, so we make it more dangerous by closing our gates, and closing our doors, and closing our invitation. And this is defended feverishly by people who call themselves Christians. All you can assume is they have never, and it's not their fault, no point in blaming them. All you can assume is they have never experienced mercy, love, grace, or infinity. They're still counting. Now, after talking about those two theological problems, which we could talk about for many more hours, I do have a CD called Hell No, if you want to. It's not as terrible as it sounds, but where I have time to make the case a little more theological. But let's move to what I would like to think is a psychological possibility and an opening. But you're going to have to be observant of your own emotional life, your own consciousness, to be able to feel the difference. There's two basic movements. There's the sucking in movement, I don't know what else to call it, when you're stingy, when you're petty, when you're blaming, when you're angry, when you want to kick even the dog, when nothing is right for you. That's a pulling back from mercy. When you're in that state, you've got to spot it early in the morning. I think it's what morning prayer means. You've got a spot there. I'm not in the flow. It is not flowing through me. It is not flowing out of me. You know, but I'm taking offense at everything. That's the first giveaway that you're in the small mind and the small heart when you're taking offense at everything. You're recounting what people did or didn't do for you. Now, we've created a modern language for these two. Well, I didn't describe the other one. If the sucking energy is the pulling back, the flowing energy is, of course, the place where grace can happen. You have to practice. I don't know what other word to say. The Buddhists have, thank God, popularized the word practice. You've got to rewire to recognize when you're not in the flow, when love is not in you and love is not flowing through you. You've got to have a little thermometer that starts beeping and saying, I better not face the day. People ask me often, how long should they pray? I said, as long as it takes you to get to yes. If your heart is still no, 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 you can't leave your prayer stool. No, you got to stay there until you find yes, till the flow happens. Now, we've created some contemporary metaphors that might make more sense to you instead of sucking and flowing. Let's call one a worldview of scarcity, and let's call the other a worldview of abundance. You've all heard that in the last 10 or 15 years. You can't show mercy. You won't. You could have heard the best sermon in the world on why you should be merciful. But you can't show mercy if you are not situated and abiding in a place of abundance. That there's more than enough of me right now. I don't have to be stingy. I don't have to be guarded. I don't have to be protected. I can let it flow and I can let it happen. Do you know this is almost perfectly exemplified in all of the multiplication stories? All those times where Jesus takes, two fish and five loaves of bread and multiplies them. And you'll notice, I think in every account that I'm aware of right now, before he does it, the good old apostles who always get it wrong, it seems, they advise him against it. Do you remember that? They say, but how will this little bit be enough for so many? There's only two fish, only five loaves of bread. And Jesus moves them from their worldview of scarcity to a worldview of abundance where there's 12 baskets left over. Brothers and sisters, the reason we have the kind of economics and politics we do in this country is because even Christians largely operate out of a worldview of scarcity. There's not enough guns, there's not enough health care, there's not enough. There's not enough. Those people have to be excluded. Those people are not worthy of it. So we have structured unmercifulness. You understand? So in the middle of structural unmercifulness, how do you turn around consciousness and teach it mercy? It's only the experience of unconditional love, unearned love, unmerited, undeserved forgiveness. You have to, one or two days of your life, for many of us it's more than that, you have to feel, I'm going to say a bad word, my mother told me not to, you have to feel like shit. You have to feel like you're at the bottom. And knowing you don't deserve it, knowing that you cannot merit it, and it still comes your way. That's when the doors of mercy blow open. That's when you begin to understand the gospel. Here's been our problem with living inside of love, living inside of mercy. We confused our great Christian biblical notion of love with Valentine's Day. I know, I don't want to undo the business of Valentine's Day. It's a nice thing, I guess. But you do know that romance and infatuation has almost nothing to do, almost nothing, with the biblical notion of love. Almost nothing. And when we play around at that level and think we're going to grow people up by waiting for their next infatuation, our next romance, we're not going to lead people very far. When I began to think this way, I went back and did a study. Did I lose that? No, here it is. Yeah. On that passage in Corinthians that you've all heard read at every wedding you've ever been a part of. And you can just see everybody glaze over, 1 Corinthians 13. Oh, yeah. We know what that one's going to say. But I want you to know he's saying some pretty extraordinary things. And if Paul had written nothing else but 1 Corinthians 13, he would be a first-rate mystic. He would be a poet of the first magnitude. He would be larger than life. If I speak with the tongues of angels or of humans, but do not have love, I'm nothing but a resounding gong. Or a clashing cymbal. It's all just noise, noise. Noise often substitutes for depth. If I have the gift of prophecy and comprehend all mysteries and all knowledge, I guess he's talking to the intellectuals, the Greeks, the people who go to Princeton, you know? If I have all the faith so as to move mountains but do not have love, I'm nothing. I'm nothing. What he's moving toward, if you follow the text, he's defining love as the fundamental, as the very nature of reality. It's not something you do, it's something you are. Sister Elia Delio, my Franciscan sister friend who I often teach with, she says, love is the physical structure of the universe. She learned that from a good Jesuit, Teilhard de Chardin. Love is the physical structure of the universe. Everything is alluring everything else, from the planets to the atoms and every animal and species in between. We're all dancing around one another, enticing one another, seducing one another, and through that dance, learning how to give to one another. Then he gets the liberal social activist. If I give away everything I own and I hand over my body to be burned, but do not have love, you can even be a real progressive, you know, generous, heroic social activist. But if you're just doing it to be special or to be angry or to be oppositional, he's saying it won't get you there. It's not the real deal. It's not the real thing. Then he describes love in about five or six different ways. Not as simply an isolated virtue, but as the basis of all virtue. Love is patient. Love is kind. Love is not jealous. And we all have to ask ourselves, well, God, I'm jealous. Maybe I'm not in love. When you're inside of this container, when you're inside of this mystery, you operate differently. And it's not in a guarded, protected way. Love is not pompous. It is not self-inflated. It is not rude. It does not seek its own interests. It is not quick-tempered. I'm sure you're familiar with different translations. It does not brood over injury. Brothers and sisters, I've been a priest 45 years now, and I sometimes think half of America is playing the victim. You know, it's the quickest way to get power while pretending you're powerless is to play the victim, to take offense. It's keeping lawyers in business, you know. Take offense. We all have a right to our legitimate offenses. But once that becomes a way of life, once that suffocates your heart, you're dead in the water. Maybe you got your $3 million for the emotional distress you suffered. But if it has suffocated your heart, you've lost. And what the gospel promises us is resurrection. You see, God always wins. That's what it means to be God. You don't lose when you're God. I remember when I was still, my first years I was stationed in Cincinnati, and I had a Catholic men's prayer breakfast. Highly successful men seemed to come to this. And I said to the group of good Catholic successful businessmen, what if the gospel is a win-win scenario? What if it's not win-lose, but it's win-win? I said, I'm convinced it is. And in fact, that's the meaning of the resurrection of all creation, which the Easter Church, by the way, understood much better than the Roman Church did, and the children of the Roman Church, which is Protestantism. We fit into this weighing and measuring and winning and losing game. But at any rate, I thought I made a pretty good case that day, that the gospel was, in fact, a win-win scenario. We had a break, as you always do, and one of these men in his good suit came up and thumbed his fingers on the podium like this, looked up at me somewhat pathetically, I must say, and he said in the most patronizing way, Father, 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 he said, win-win, that wouldn't even be interesting. It wouldn't to most people who still live inside of meritocracy, who still live inside of weighing and measuring and earning and performing, which is the American game. It's the only game in town. and you have not been transferred from the kingdom of darkness to the kingdom of light till you make that transfer by the grace of God. And like God lifting up the prophet Habakkuk by the hair and placing him where he needed him to be placed, that's how God works with his saints. You find yourself thinking out of a largesse, out of a magnanimity, out of a generosity of spirit. Not a stingy orthodoxy, but a generous orthodoxy. Love does not brood over injuries. It does not rejoice over wrongdoing. So that part of you that wants to take delight in other people's failure or sin, that's not love, which means it's not God, which means it's not going to get you there. It's a dead end. Love bears all things. I mean, that's a pretty. Believes all things. Sounds like naivete. Hopes all things. Endures all things. Love never fails. Basically, what he's trying to say, it's the open heart. And the work of spirituality is to teach you how to keep your heart open in hell. Because hell will happen in this world. And that's what Pope John Paul II said, I can tell you the very day, June 29th, 1989, in a general assembly in Rome. He said, when will Catholics realize heaven and hell are not geographical places, they're states of consciousness? Pope John Paul II. I can tell right now when people are in hell. It's on their face. It's written all over them. They wouldn't give you the time of day. They can't eke out a smile. There's no generosity of spirit. It's all sucking in energy, sucking in. And you feel, lesser when you allow yourself to be sucked into that. So we know that God has to be 1,000 times more loving than the most loving person you've ever met. So I want you all to think. Who's the most loving person? I hope you met one. If you hadn't, you can't imagine this. You can't imagine it. If all you met were abusive people in your life, that's what you think the world is, and you're in hell. You're in hell right now. And what the gospel invites you into is something much bigger than that, much better than that, and it happens now. Love never fails. In the end, there will be faith, hope and love remaining, and the greatest of these is love. So, brothers and sisters, let me say this. Mercy is not a virtue that you choose to put on one day. Mercy has to be your deepest way of seeing. This way of generosity of spirit. Drawing your identity from your deepest dignity, which is love. You are made in love, you are children of God, created in God's image, and when you operate out of love, you operate out of your dignity. And you feel, to use our American language, you feel good about yourself. You do. This is to your own advantage. When you are small and stingy and lacking in generosity of spirit, you do not operate out of your deepest identity. You do not operate out of your deepest dignity. So love always wins. Love is the very shape of reality. And what your prayer must be every day is to learn how to resituate yourself there. It's work. It's awful work because the voices of resistance will be constant. The ego knows itself by constriction, by pulling back. It likes to be separate, and it likes to be superior. And it'll play any game it can to be separate or superior. The soul opens itself up. It doesn't know itself by constriction. It knows itself by expansion. There's always room for more. There's always room for another place at the table. And most of us have to be converted to that love every day. Because it's what it means, I think, to be converted to God, who is that love and who is that mercy. So I pray that through my probably confused remarks, I pray that in the last hour, you've somehow heard the gospel. It will always be the most counterintuitive, impossible logic that your common sense will want to fight or resist or oppose. But it's the Spirit who leads you there. It's the Spirit who teaches you there. And all you can really do is allow it to happen. You can't force yourself to go there. You allow yourself to be led there. And I promise you, once you let go, once you stop holding on and clenching your fists, this is where God and grace always lead you. Thank you.
This recording is copyright by the Center for Action and Contemplation. Learn more about Richard Rohr at cac.org.